Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 342, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined, as ever, by my friend and co-host, James Stacey. James, you're at the cottage today. It's feeling rather autumnal, I hear.
I am, yeah. We actually only got up Sunday afternoon, so we've only been here for a bit, and then I moved the recording forward because I want to try and get two recordings in next week because, obviously, Labor Day and then the days right after that are going to be quite busy.
Yeah.
Certainly for myself, but I'm assuming for you, too. And so we've mixed up the schedule just a little bit, but yeah, I'm up at the cottage. It's an absolutely gorgeous day, but it's kind of up and down in terms of temperature, and right now it's much more of a fall temperature than a summer one. We've definitely had Octobers that are warmer than today. It's a little bit on the chilly side, but I'm not against it. It's fine. It's nice to be up here. I'm probably going to pump up the kayak for a little paddle this afternoon. Maybe go for a little walk. Take the camera out, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's been a nice little weekend. How about you? What have you been up to since we talked last? I mean, obviously you've had an adventure into the big city.
Yeah, back from New York Friday night, and kind of just spent the weekend getting resettled here. You know, getting caught up on household stuff, and went for a run, and just ever since we got back, like the temperature just changed completely, and it really felt like fall this weekend. And I love this weather. I find it, really makes it easier to kind of just do stuff day to day without always kind of dripping in sweat and, feeling kind of sluggish. But on the other hand, it does have that bit of melancholy foreboding that the season's going to change. And, I don't want to get too negative here, but, then that brings winter behind that and whatever. So I just want to hold on to summer a little longer. And I think we'll get back to it for another month or so. But I'm not complaining. I built a fire outside last night, and that felt kind of nice.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's some wildfires around my cottage, so I don't believe I'm allowed to do a fire. I think it's a full ban.
Wow.
Currently, I think the fires are under control now, but it's been an issue for the last few weeks in this area, not too far from us. But yeah, I agree. Like, I'm not against the fall, but I don't want it in August.
Right. Yeah.
I mean? Like, I still want the days where, like, I feel like I have to get in the water.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you take what you're going to get. It's sunny and nice here today, so I'm certainly not complaining. And I've still got, that sort of modified lightened schedule, just a few things to deal with each day. In honor of last week's guest, I realized that, some time ago I had bought a copy of Terminal List and only read maybe the first few chapters. And then it was probably around the time that the first season of the TV show came out.
Yeah.
Jack was a delight to have on the show, and I thought you did a great job chatting with him. And I was like, let's go back and do this. I pulled it up on my Kindle. It was $3 for the first one, and I read it, and I finished at about 4 a.m. this morning.
Gosh.
I was up. The young lad decided to wake up after sleeping for a very long time, and he was up with a shout. And I was like, I probably only have like two chapters left. Let me finish this.
Wow.
And I put it down. So it went down in just a couple of days, and I enjoyed it. It's super pulpy. I think it reads a lot like a James Bond.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
A James Bond that's more violent and less suits.
Yeah.
what I mean? Like, it's exceptionally violent.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's coming from Chain Gang All-Stars and Heart of the West and some of this other stuff I've been reading lately, which is also exceptionally violent. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I immediately bought the next one.
Yeah.
So I'm just finished the first chapter of book two. And then with Dark Wolf, which is the TV show, I believe largely about Ben Edwards, which is of course a prequel to Terminal List, that comes out in just 2 days. So I'm going to make a concerted effort to watch all of that before I have to go back to work.
Yeah.
And just kind of, I'll just kind of buzz through it if I can. But like I said, I'm a Taylor Kitsch fan. I like seeing him in stuff. I enjoyed seeing him in Terminal List. I just finished American Primeval, which he is one of the lead roles in, and it was good. But yeah, so that's what I've been up to for the last little while. Beyond that, and beyond recording from the cottage, so apologies if the sound is a little bit different than normal. I'm handheld and on more of a field setup. I don't know, Jason, if you saw that our buddy Ed Jelly, who works with Tactile Turn, but he's a great member of the TGN Slack. He started 3D printing these. And I'll put it in the show notes if he's okay with me sharing it beyond the Slack. But he started 3D printing these little cages for your Apple Watch Ultra as like a weekend phone.
Oh, cool.
So it limits what you can do. You can't sit there and scroll Instagram and the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I love this idea very much. So I just spoke to Ed and ordered one kind of as quickly as I could. I believe he's either shipping it to you and you can bring it up for Toronto Timepiece, or maybe he's decided to ship it to me. Either way, I'll get one eventually and report back on that. I would love the idea of having something where I can still do my podcast. That's my main thing about like going to a dumb phone,
yeah,
quote unquote, is like I wouldn't have Pocket Casts.
Right.
Whereas if I did something with the Apple Watch with a cell connection, I could still do my podcast and not really miss out on much else that I care about, which is good. So I'm going to give that a try. But Ed's little chat about or like post about 3D printing, I spent the last several days going down like a 3D printing rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And honestly, by the time this episode comes out, I may have a machine en route.
How much do they cost? I mean, where are they at now?
So the Bamboo Labs A1, this is an aside, but a good friend of mine does 3D printing professionally.
Yeah.
He has, I think, well over 20 machines, maybe, and for a very successful Etsy store that has become his full-time living.
Yeah.
And I wrote him because the A1 is like $400 Canadian right now.
Wow, geez.
And I said, like, is this the one? And he goes, man, I've owned from the A1 to like the $1,500 X1 Carbon. He's like, if I was doing this at your level or even at what I do for Etsy, I would just buy, I wish I'd bought 40 A1s instead of these more expensive ones.
Yeah.
So I'm looking into it. Ed bought an A1 for what he's working on, but he bought it with the multicolor thing. So it's a little bit more money, not quite double, but it can print, it can blend four different filaments, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't care about printing in color, at least not at this point in my 3D printing career. But I do really love the idea of being able to share that with my kids and work on fun little projects. And my daughters are very crafty types, so I think there's probably a lot of craft applications. I made the mistake of going on the internet and finding all of these printing projects for the IKEA Scadis pegboard, which I have a wall of in my office. And there's all these things that you can print that fit into the pegboard for like really clean like layouts of stuff. And so, yeah, I'm down the rabbit hole. That's kind of the other thing. So big thanks to Ed. Ed, if you're listening to this, I look forward to getting your little Apple Watch case. But also, you know, you may have cost me more than just whatever you charged me for the product.
This is wild. I mean, it reminds me of, I haven't really looked into this until you mentioned this. I assumed it was a lot more costly to get into this space, but it reminds me of what I've said before about, and I'm probably sounding like an old man now, and I am, but like, just the trickle down of and how quickly everything from, you know, digital cameras went to drones. I mean, this sort of technology would have seemed, you know, even 15, 20 years ago would have just seemed outrageous and, you know, just so futuristic. Yeah. And now to get a 3D printer for $350 is what I'm seeing.
Yeah. I mean, and crazy. That's from the brand, like the most populous brand. I'm sure there's options from lesser known brands that require more setup, more fine tuning, more understanding of 3D printing. This is like a take it out of the box, screw a couple pieces together and start printing solution.
Amazing.
I don't want this to become some brand new hobby for me, but I do love the idea of like, oh, I want something for my desk, I can print it. I want something, my daughters want something for a project at school, we can print it. I want something to, you know, hold memory cards for my camera. Like, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I might talk myself into it, but I too was kind of surprised when, you know, Ed said he had jumped into it with his kid. And I was like, oh, I wonder what we're talking about in terms of price. Because I had looked at some of the stuff that shows up on YouTube, these, you know, $2,000, $3,000 machines that can print in metal and really interesting things. But the basic stuff that prints kind of the standard, you know, plastic, not that expensive anymore. So pretty compelling as far as maybe a little something to get into over the cooler months.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I was down another rabbit hole. I was looking at both the what is it called, the, you know, the new truck that Amazon came out with, is it the Slate?
Yeah, I think that's the name of it, but yes, I know what you mean. That and the Scout.
I mean, the Scout is the one that really piques my interest, and those are part of this new generation of vehicle that kind of accepts various sort of 3D printed components and
accessories
for attaching things inside, and it's really opened up a whole new space and a whole new sort of outlet for creativity. So that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those trucks, you know, providing they get off the ground and people enjoy driving them and there's a service network, like all the things that require a car, that a car requires to become an active part of like a population.
Yeah.
I think that could be quite fascinating. But man, I can't imagine the challenge those brands are up against.
Yeah.
To deliver that at the price they've said, with the sort of you know, dealer support network and things like that. You look at something like a product as cool and well made as like the Ineos, mm-hmm. and even that had people saying like, look, this thing's made like a full ton truck. It's tough. It's really nice. It's got a bunch of great parts on it. But also, what happens when one breaks? Like, how close do you live to an Ineos dealer,
right?
Or that sort of thing. So I mean, yeah, it's something to consider. But I think the appeal of those. The Scout, and yeah, I think Slate sounds right. I didn't pay a ton of attention to it, but the appeal of them at that price point,
yeah,
it seems quite high. I think both of them are kind of sub 30 is the plan.
Yeah, yeah,
which is, you know, I think compelling in today's market.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, before we get into Risk Check and our main topic, we've got a couple of kind of recurring announcements, a little housekeeping that we've been doing over the past few episodes. You want to catch people up on, well, how about the marathon party?
For sure. Yeah, I can actually get through both of these really quickly, sure. So we don't spend a ton of time on it. First of all, like we've mentioned for the last couple of episodes, the marathon party RSVP link is in the show notes for the last couple episodes. It's in the show notes for this one. We're at about something like 75% capacity, so it's going really well. We have just a little bit less than a month before we do it. It is the evening of September 21st, the Sunday of the Toronto Timepiece Show. It's a little hangout between us and Marathon, a direct repeat of last year. I'm actually just trying to decide if we go with Creative Arts beer again, or I'm considering Son and Hill, which I've become quite a fan of as well. So working through a few of the really kind of fun things you get to do when you do something like this. But the party is free. The beer is free. The wine's free. The charcuterie is free. It's just a great time. So if you'd like to hang out with us the evening, again, that's a Sunday evening of the Toronto Timepiece Show. All the details and the RSVP link are in the show notes. And then the second one is please continue to send in your Q&A questions. We're going to start kicking off Q&A episodes to catch up with our backlog starting in September. So there'll be lots of extra episodes for people over the next few months. And if you'd like to get a question in, there's a good chance you'll get it answered. We're getting a lot of questions in, which is amazing, but we've got a lot of questions we need to answer to fill these shows. So if you've got a question for us, could be funny, could be serious, could be about watches, could be about something else. Let us know if you'd like us to kind of, you know, ramble on for 5 or 10 minutes about your question. We'd be happy to put it into the queue and get it into a future episode. So with the housekeeping out of the way, yeah, let's dive into a little bit of Risk Check. You want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. I pulled out a watch I haven't worn in a while. This is the Vertex M60 Aqualion. I've got it on the bracelet, which is quite excellent, actually. And I had pulled it out a few weeks ago when it was remarkably more humid and warm here. And the mm-hmm. bracelet was sized for, I suppose, my winter wrist, maybe. And it was a little snug, so I put it away. But today, with it being a little cooler, it's just a nice loose feel on my wrist. And you know, it's just one of those watches that every time I pull it out and put it on, I just think like I need to wear this more. It's just such a great piece.
They're so good, man.
Yeah, yeah. How about you? What do you got on?
Yeah, it's a bit of a broken record. I spent a bunch of the week wearing the Doxa sub 200. Then knowing I was coming up to the cottage, I wanted to switch to something a little bit more multi-role, a little bit, you know, just something what am I saying? It's the Aqualion. I can't take this thing off. But now I've got a problem where I've got the Loom dial, which everybody's aware of. I've talked a ton. I've got the 40th anniversary, and now I feel like I need a black dial.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm looking at there was a Japan LE. I'm looking at everything on eBay and just considering like, do I need a third Aqualion? And like, if I buy a third modern one, why don't I own a CO23?
Yeah.
So do I need four?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here? I don't know. This watch really encapsulates a lot of what I love about watches. It doesn't cost a ton. It is a huge amount of fun. It's super quirky and full of personality and weird. And, you know, we talked about the Watch of Espionage story about these watches previously. And that actually leads me to the second part, which is since I got this watch, I've been wearing it on that two-piece T-strap canvas style nylon strap. I think I sent you one. It's a very nice option for the watch. It suits the watch well and wears really nicely. And especially with the color of this case, you know, I didn't put it on one of the elastic or the like fabric pull through style ones, the Wochis.
Yeah.
That I was commonly wearing the other one on. But then, like I mentioned last week, I read that Watches of Espionage story, and in a lot of the images they showed guys wearing it on the previous generation style rubber strap from Citizen that has like the ND tables on it.
Yeah.
So I like I've had that for watches that had like 20 millimeter straps. I've never had a 24 millimeter ND Citizen strap.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd just see what was available online. And it turns out, of course, people make essentially knockoffs of these straps.
Sure.
So I grabbed one on Amazon for $25. Today, $27.42 Canadian, but it's coming from the States, so it's probably about $20, maybe $18 in the States.
Yeah,
and it's from MCXGL. It's the 24 millimeter silicone watch band compatible with Citizen Hyper Aqualand Duplex ProMaster Men's Dive Strap Sport Waterproof Wristband. So, unlike the Citizen ones, in my experience, which are like rubber,
yeah,
with this strap that I bought that I'm wearing today, it's that sort of velvety textured silicone.
Yeah.
So it's super comfortable, like immediately comfortable because it's so soft, it holds no real shape. And it's nicely elastic. I would say on my wrist at 7 inches, I'm on the second smallest hole. So it's quite a large strap.
Yeah.
And I also cut off a piece of the tail that was too long. To kind of balance it out. And I find it quite comfortable. I would say that the ND table is under the buckle sometimes, depending on how tight I wear
yeah.
it. As long as you don't mind that sort of velvety one. And often these ones pick up a lot of lint.
Right.
Which I was texting with Ben Lowry about. And that will be a pain if that's how this goes. So far, I've been wearing it for 3 days, basically nonstop, and it hasn't picked up any lint. It's a little bulky on my wrist. So like if you're sensitive to a strap, maybe not overpowering the watch, but maybe overpowering your wrist at times.
Yeah,
this may not be the one for you, but I'm liking it, and I'll probably keep wearing it. I find it super comfortable. I've slept with the watch on the last couple nights, so
yeah,
no complaints on that front. Nice little strap for $25. Nothing special, but certainly wearable.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the things that I always loved about the original ND Limits Citizen straps was the metal keepers. I just think such a failure point on so many straps, especially softer, you know, silicone straps, brittle rubber ones.
Yep.
Those keepers, they'll just deteriorate, crack, or fall off. And the metal keepers, even though they can pull hair a little bit, it was just such a smart sort of thing to do. And it just added to kind of the purpose built, mm-hmm. you know, thoughtfulness of that whole watch package. And I think, I mean, I've seen Seiko do some metal keepers, and I think Citizen still does a few, but just a great.
Yeah. Well, I think the keeper on the stock strap for the Aqualand is like a wide metal,
yeah.
if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very nice like quality strap, but it's quite rigid. And, sometimes I find it quite comfortable to wear, and other times I want something that feels less bulky.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, this strap, it's not as good as the T-strap at double the price.
Yeah.
But if you want something that really does look the part of the Aqualand, which is, you know, with the rippled rubber, the vented rubber, and you know, the kind of compression for a wetsuit and that sort of thing. And it would definitely fit over a wetsuit stock. So I would say if you're, you know, 7 inches or up on the wrist, you probably could enjoy it. And I think it wears quite well.
Yeah. Well, as we were talking, I had just forwarded you a link on Slack from the Buy Sell Trade forum or channel, because a guy named Andrew is selling a JP2000 with the blue, dark blue dial, which is very sharp. And I think I knew about these.
Oh, is it for sale? Because somebody was trying to trade one.
No, it is sale and at a good price.
Are you going to buy that?
Nope. It's pretty sweet.
Interesting.
It's pretty sweet.
Interesting.
Dark blue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's cool. No gold accents, all blue.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty compelling.
And no bracelet.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2067L. All yeah, right, cool,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Looks good.
Anyway, you can keep that in if you want. Another live purchase.
Yeah. We've deviated, but yeah, that's wrist check for the week. And we've got kind of a fun, you know, light topic for today's episode, which kind of covers the backstory of your involvement with the launch of a very exciting new dive watch. I think quite exciting. From Paulin, called the Mara.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've talked about it in bits and pieces. You've done a bit about the project in the Hebrides. But I don't know if we've kind of told maybe the whole story back to back. So I thought maybe that would make for a decent topic today, because, you know, it's the end of summer. Most watch brands are keeping their cards close to their chest for Geneva Watch Days, which starts a little more than a week away. And so I thought it might be fun to kind of kick off by maybe a quick summary of the experience. You talked a lot about like the travel in Scotland, because mm-hmm. we did an episode about it. but less so about the actual like project, like building the content and, right. and the video and that sort of thing. How did all that come about? Did you know? Because I know that you're close with Lewis at Interdane.
Yeah. So if you remember, a little over two years ago, I went to Scotland in May of, I believe it was 23. Lewis was kind enough to loan his Defender for a road trip for a couple of weeks. And then I recorded an episode with him at Unordained's headquarters with him. And you can find that in our back catalog, but
put it in the show notes.
But I remember sitting there with him at Unordained's offices and there was some discussion about the development of a dive watch. And I, on that trip, I was wearing my Blancpain, my 50 Fathoms. And I know Lewis is a fan of that watch. He likes the aesthetic of it. And he and one of their designers, we sat down in an office there and we just started kind of going through some of their early drawings and ideas. And I was giving some feedback about what's important in a dive watch, you know, the strap, the bezel, the, you know, dial color or no dial color, contrast, stuff like that. And, you know, as we were talking, I kind of joked with him that, you know, come launch time, I'm game to do some kind of a help out with some kind of a launch campaign. And I suggested that we take it up to Scapa Flow, which is this sheltered bay area up in the Orkney Islands in Scotland, where the British Navy scuttled the German fleet after World War One, and there's a lot of wrecks to dive. And I said, oh, you know, we should go up there and do some photography and video and stuff underwater for this watch. And then it was this past winter when he got in touch and said, well, we're going to launch a dive watch under the Paulin name, not under the Unordained name. And he sent a few early photos and we got kind of going back and forth. And I said, you know, this watch, it has more of a playful, I don't want to say casual casual look to it than something you'd take on a dark, cold wreck dive on military wrecks in the far north. Mm-hmm. I said it feels more like a coastal adventuring in and out of the water, you know, some swimming, some hiking, some kind of just general travel kind of a vibe to it. And he agreed. So he pretty quickly cooked up this idea of going to the Outer Hebrides to do this photo and video shoot to support the launch of this watch. And so that's what led to my trip back in early May, in which Christy and I flew over there and to Glasgow. And this time we rented a Defender, as I mentioned on that earlier episode. And we drove across the sky and took a ferry over to the Isle of Harris and did that whole adventure. And I don't need to recap the whole adventure, but what was fun about it was we were able to involve a small team from not only from Paulin / Unordained, because they're sort of sister companies, pull in a really talented photographer, videographer, Brad Wakefield, who's a TGN
shout out Brad
listener, and just a guy that, you know, I don't know how, and Brad might remember, but how I met him or how I became acquainted, but it was probably one of these Instagram trading DMs sort of scenario, as well as his involvement or his listening to TGN. And he was literally the only diving, you know, photographer that did topside end diving stuff in the UK. And so I said to Lewis, I said, you know, I think I know somebody that might be able to help us. And I got in touch with Brad. Brad was very game to take on the job. And then Brad just became this great resource for putting together this trip. He'd been to the Outer Hebrides. He knew these islands. He knew some great spots to do some shooting, these long causeways that connect the islands where you sort of drive on these very narrow roads across, you know, bodies of water. He knew some good beaches and some good places to do some open water swimming and some free diving. And so Brad really put together a great itinerary for us. And, you know, as I discussed back in that episode back in May, when I got back, it turned out really well. And then from then it was just a matter of kind of waiting for some things to be finalized with both the watch and with the video and the photography. And we kind of had this WhatsApp group among us that were on the trip, and they were kind of trading snippets and photos and you know, sort of video edits that turned into what, you know, what we all saw, I guess, last week when the watch was launched. And I think it was well received. I think it turned out really well.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, we can dig into the Brooklyn side of it, kind of coming halfway around the world or a third of the way around the world to launch the watch sometime later last week.
Yeah.
But let's get into the watch itself, because some people might have missed it. Certainly it showed up on the Slack and we covered it on Hodinkee. But it's a dive watch offered in two versions, a black or a blue. It's 39.7 millimeters with a steel case. 13.5 including the crystal, 10.8 thick without, and 48 millimeters lug to lug. It's 300 meters water resistance. The dial is lacquer with Super Luminova markers. I think quite interesting markers, a mix of circles, triangles, squares, and then 12 and 6. The branding I really like as far as the naming on the watch, because it's kept to the minute track surrounding the dial. So you have almost a very sterile feeling, almost. It's weird. It's like if you know, the Cali dial, like the Panerai,
right,
symbols on one side. This is almost like a Glasgow dial, I guess.
Yeah.
Cause it feels a little bit like a Cali dial because it has a mix of symbols and numbers, but it has this geometric balance due to largely the triangles,
uh-huh,
and the application of the circle markers at 11, 1, 5, and 7. It's an interesting design. It has a kind of a large, chunkier style bezel in terms of its relation to the proportions of the dial, and then the markings on the dial, the hands, and the bezel are luminous. And I think they come with a rubber strap and a fabric strap as well. And then looking at the Canadian price on the website here in the $2,300 range, you know, what are you seeing for a U.S. price? I think it's based on about a €1,500 price point.
Yeah, so in U.S. it's $1,686. So a very specific number, no doubt derived from a, you know, conversion from euros. So
yeah, so into that somewhat more premium space for a micro brand, but in the pollen pricing.
Yeah, it is. It sort of occupies that sub $2,000 space. That's a pretty crowded space. But I think, you know, what you're getting with the kind of more slightly higher level movement from La Jupere, and then the lacquer dial, and just
I left that out. It's a G101,
yeah,
automatic.
Yeah,
yeah. An uprated movement.
Yeah, nice movement. From the reviews I read, both on Hodinkee and Fratello and Monochrome and some others, I think by and large it has been well received. And I think the most common, mm-hmm, comment I've seen, even in just the comments on these articles, is it doesn't look like anything else, which I think is a really hard thing to achieve, especially in the dive watch space these days. And as you were describing its look, and I'm looking at the photo on the website, on Pollen's website, you know, when you talk about the kind of the oversized bezel with the small dial, it has that sort of Doxa-esque feel to it in terms of the case shape and the dial to bezel ratio, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that price point puts it, you know, pretty squarely against something like a sub 200 or even a sub two, you know, it's less than a 250T, I believe, a little bit more than a 200.
Yeah.
Similar in size at about 40 millimeters, a little under. And then, you're getting a quirky design. I think a pretty viable option from a brand that's downstream of Ann Ordain. So you're not buying a Kickstarter brand. This is, you know, they know what they're doing. They've been making watches, you know, Roldorf in Vancouver supports the brand. So I know that they've been, you know, seen and worked on by a watchmaker I trust in general as far as the quality. And I like this a lot. I would definitely consider one of these, especially if they expand into, like, I think this is a great platform for a more interesting colorway than black or blue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like an orange would be really exciting for a watch like this.
Yeah. And I've seen some renders of, you know, I don't know if it was kind of early design ideas or plans for the future, but of quite a palette of different colors. And Pollen is no stranger to
that. Cool.
They do a lot with color.
True.
You know, the two launch colors, there were, you know, insider secret here, there were originally going to be three colors, but they were kind of having some trouble with the third colorway. So they decided to hold that one back. But the blue and the black are the two that are available now. And I think our strategy on the, during the photo and video shoot over in the islands there in Scotland was, you know, let's use the black one for kind of more of the topside adventure stuff, the driving and the hiking part of the photos and video, and reserve the blue with the rubber strap for the diving and the water stuff. And I, you know, for obvious reasons, but I love the blue. I would love to put the blue on the black fabric strap. That's the way I would wear that one. I'm not much for matching strap color to dial color. I just have never been that way.
Okay. You know,
a lot of people like orange straps on an orange Doxa, et cetera. I don't
sure
kind of roll that way, but the black one really speaks to me. I love the black with that gray bezel with that little bit
the
of pop
pale
of
gray
yellow.
Bezel is great.
It has that ghost bezel. I mean, people like that, you know, it's not a big secret.
And I like the font that they've used. It feels almost automotive for the bezel.
Yeah. Right.
It feels like something you might see in an Autodromo.
Right.
Which I mean as an absolute compliment.
Yeah.
I love the intentionality of the color, where the black one has the gray bezel with the yellow accent. The blue has a dark blue dial with a bright blue, almost like a Halios Tropic.
Yeah.
Bright blue bezel insert, but a little bit of yellow at the end of the seconds hand just to keep that kind of similarity across. I mean, Paulin, one of their calling cards, is kind of a fun and exciting use of color, especially primary colors.
Yeah.
And I think that they filled this out here. I love the sort of tonneau cushion-y sort of case and their super chunky hands. I assume you've seen it in person. The loom must be pretty solid.
Yeah, loom is good. And one thing I like about it too is that they've kind of mimicked the hands at first glance kind of look sort of simplistic, but it harkens to those old IWC hands where the minute hand is sort of squared off at the end and narrow. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked that look. I think, you know, one thing I told them is, you know, that's important with a dive watch is to kind of distinguish the minute hand from the hour hand. And I think they've done a good job here without going in a very conventional route, which would be, you know, a sword hand or, you know, some of their plongeur or that style thing. I think they've kind of done their own thing here. And in terms of the dial markings, you know, you talked about that and the font that's used on the bezel. But one thing I read in, I think it was a review on Fratello, was that, and now I cannot not see it, is the use of the triangle markers. You know, at first glance, I always just saw them as pointing in towards the center of the dial. But when you look at it now, the top triangles point up and the bottom triangles point down. So it's almost like an up-down mm-hmm. sort of feature that I can't unsee that now. It's all I see when I look at
it. Looks a bit
dial.
Like the volume button on a remote control.
Yeah. And then the same, you mentioned the dots, and the dots kind of mm-hmm. have that same tweak to them too, where it creates this symmetry on the dial that you can look at either horizontally or vertically. And it's just,
yeah,
it's pretty wild. It kind of does a trick with my eyes now.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go as far as to say like that I haven't seen this, or I can say I haven't seen this on a watch before, but that hasn't been done before. Nothing's new under the sun in watchmaking, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't immediately recall a dial with this sort of a layout, with this use of such a various array of markers without it somehow feeling messy.
Yeah.
It feels quite concise. It feels easy to read. I think they look quite good. Yeah, I like this. I think they've done a nice job. I think the at about €1,500, the price point makes sense.
Right.
For a watch with a G100 from a brand that people, you know, have a strong affinity for.
Yeah.
To their credit, it doesn't look like other dive watches, which I think is value. It doesn't look like a Sub. It doesn't look like a Planet Ocean. I think they've done a nice job of making something that feels like a dive watch but has its own personality. So cool on them for that. And we'll certainly put all this in the show notes, of course. And to be clear, we're not getting paid to talk about this. I literally picked this episode topic late last night and told Jason it might be nice just to kind of hear the whole story of this.
Yeah.
We like Paulin. We like Lewis. Would love to have him on the show again in the future. And Ordain's very impressive in what they've done. But yeah, we're just covering this because, you know, we thought it would be a fun topic and something to talk about both watches and the adventure of putting all together. But look, I think to sort of close the story out, if you will,
yeah.
Why don't you walk us through, because I know there was some of the crew at the Brooklyn event. Why don't you give us a quick rundown of the Brooklyn event and how that went?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. It was, came about a couple of months ago when they picked the date for the actual launch, and they did it in collaboration with the Wind Up Shop, our buddies over at Worn and Wound. And I had never been to their shop, but we ended up staying at a hotel just literally around the corner from it, which was very convenient. And Katie from Paulin was the representative from the brand who came, and she's a really great person. And I kind of had some exchanges with her virtually, but never met in person. And so we kind of went back and forth to kind of come up with a plan for it. And our friend, Kyle Snar, was there from
Shadow Kyle,
Worn and Wound. And he was the moderator of a little bit of a Q&A that we did that night at the event, when they had, you know, catered food and Brooke Lodick, the Scotch whiskey company, was there pouring samples of two different whiskeys.
Hey, which was fun. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Very fitting. And they had kind of a full range of Paulin watches, not just the Mara Diver, but several of their other watches. And it was a good turnout. I would say, I don't know, I wasn't clicking the counter at the door, but, you know, it's, you know, 100 folks, 100 people or so showed. I mean, it was a pretty packed place for a small space. And I saw a couple of TGN orange caps. I saw some TGN t-shirts. Not going to remember all the names of the TGN folks I met, but there was a really good contingent of listeners there, and a lot of CWN1s. I mean, there were a lot of the crew watches there. I saw probably 5 different ones, and
amazing.
People really turned out and came and said hello, and it was a lot of fun. And we, after about an hour of kind of just mingling and chatting with people, we went in kind of a side room, and Kyle did a short Q&A where we talked about the watch itself and kind of diving with it kind of testing it out and some of the design elements. And it was just an all around great time. I mean, it's just really fun, having not gone to Watches and Wonders or Wind Up Chicago. It was kind of my first time this year kind of getting out there at a watch event, and it felt good. It felt really good to kind of meet some people and have some food and some whiskey and just kind of chat about watches and kind of feel the enthusiasm for this new watch. It was really fun. Kind of came full circle to the whole project.
I haven't had the ability or the opportunity, the pleasure, however you'd like to put it, to visit the Worn & Wound studio there, the space they have in Brooklyn. How is it?
Yeah, it's really cool. I've learned from them that it's actually their office. Their office is kind of in a little side or back space there. They just kind of pull a curtain across. But the main room itself is just a long tables down the middle, and then sort of kind of workbench style along each wall with pegboard. And then they have straps hanging, and they have some EDC stuff. And then they just kind of have watches laid out there for viewing. And it's a pretty open, I feel like industrial is an overused word, but it kind of has that feel to it. Sort of a workshop feel. It feels like you're going into like someone's wood shop, except much cleaner.
They always kind of had that vibe with their booth at Wind Up, like with pegboards holding up some of the gear and that sort of thing, which I always kind of appreciated.
Yeah. It did have that same feel to it. They've really kind of translated that to their presence at the Wind Up shows as well. So it was good. And Blake and Zach and Devin and Griffin and a bunch of other guys were there, and that was really nice to
fantastic
catch up with those guys as well, and Kat and Myra from Worn & Wound. So it was a really good time, and it was great. And then Christy came along for this trip, and she was at the event, but then we also had a good time exploring Brooklyn. I had never been to Brooklyn. I kind of went back and forth with you a little bit ahead of the trip, and I got some recommendations for food and things to do there from some listeners on Slack. And we made the most of what really amounted to about 2.5 days there. We went to the Brooklyn Museum and the Botanical Gardens, which is really spectacular. Had some good food at a place called Runner and Stone. It was a really great breakfast spot and good baked goods. We walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. We went to Governor's Island kind of made the most of a couple really pleasant days there. It was raining the first day, just sort of a drizzle, but the next 2 days were pretty sunny and warm and really nice. So yeah, kind of had my New York fix for first time in a couple of years. So it was great.
Well, that's great, man. Yeah, I'm glad that all worked out. And I think it was a pretty cool project to see you be part of, launching a new dive watch and one that I think is pretty rad. And I'm looking forward to eventually seeing it in person. Maybe that'll be in Vancouver. Maybe somewhere else. We'll have to see in the next little while. But why don't we jump into some final notes?
Sure. Why don't I give my voice a rest a bit? You can go first.
For sure. Yeah. Mine's actually kind of a fun one, but it doesn't have to take a super long time. So this week, I think actually just today on Monday, Chris Harris posted a video driving a Veyron, a Bugatti Veyron, that's going up for auction soon. And it got me thinking about the Veyron, and I realized, that car is now 20 years old. It came out in 2005, because I drove one in 2014, and I've talked about it on the show before, and it was so long ago, it's not really that immense of a story. It's an exceptionally fast car, as you expect, and I signed some exceptional paperwork to be able to go for a drive.
Where was that?
That was at the Quail in 2014, so the car show, and they had Andy Wallace. You can Google him. He's an absolute king of a man. I believe he drove the Veyron and the Chiron to its world record speeds. X-Factory driver, just an all-around good guy. He was in the right seat. They weren't just handing the keys to, I believe they sold it later that day. But I mean, look, it a few hours before somebody spent $3 million on that Veyron, I guess it was a Grand Sport Vitesse, maybe. Huh. I'd have to go back and check. I wrote a story in 2014 for a blog to watch about it. But a few hours before someone paid, a lifetime's worth of money for that car, I think I drove it and Ted Gashu drove it and Anish drove it. And I think, it had been put through its paces, at least as far as you can put a car like that through its paces on public roads. But yeah, we're just out by the Quail, like in that area, kind of on the direction towards, say, Laguna Seca. So there's some roads there that some people listening will know. But as I was listening to Chris's video, and I'll include his video in the show notes, it led me back to a very fond memory of an episode of Top Gear where they race Jeremy in a Bugatti Veyron, and he's racing so from Italy to London to deliver some, the conceit is he's delivering some truffles to a restaurant. And Richard Hammond and James May were going to do the whole same trip in a Cessna 182 because James May had just gotten his pilot's license.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what they were racing against between the plane and this car. And, you know, I look back very fondly on that, and I realized that episode was also from 2005, December. And I remember very fondly, like, watching that when that night that it was brand new. You know, at the time you had to torrent episodes of Top Gear, and that's what you would do to catch up on these episodes. But I wanted to just recommend one. I'll also include, there's a Top Gear races Wikipedia page where you can go back and watch all of these races where they race Ferrari 612 to Verbier against the train, and like, all, they're great, they're really fun. And they're not as popular, maybe a subgenre of Top Gear episodes, as like the big challenges where they have to buy a car and go drive across a desert or whatever.
Yeah.
But as that sub thing, you know, these are 10-12 minutes long when they're edited into a single thing, and the Top Gear YouTube channel has put almost all of them on the website.
Oh,
as
wow.
Far as I can tell. So my suggestion is to go back and watch the 2005. It's from Series 7, Episode 5, the Bugatti Veyron race, or Bugatti Veyron versus a Cessna, depending on the titling on YouTube. Great video, great piece of like classic Top Gear. And it's weird for me to think that that's 20 years ago.
That is crazy, yeah.
Because it just doesn't, it feels like five in my memory. Yeah. But some great episodes in that list of the races. But there's something so exceptional and so end of a certain generation about the Veyron that even if you look at it and you go, that's ridiculous, it's a hypercar, it's for incredibly rich people, it's barely a real thing. All of that is true, but at the same time, it's a marvel of engineering. And there's even some incredible videos that Henry's done visiting their factory, I think are more around the era of the Chiron.
Yeah.
And I talking about all the engineering that goes into these cars and that sort of thing. And sure, maybe the product is silly in the end, but there's something I think very human about such an insane thing, even if I'm never going to be able to afford one. And of course, was very fortunate to have had some seat time. And then later on, I drove a Chiron in Vancouver when I was writing for Nouveau.
Wow.
You know, they're totally inappropriate things on public roads. And they also don't make any sense on a racetrack. They really are kind of engineering for engineering's sake. I just, they're very impressive things. And I think where, sure, you could, like Chris says in his video, you could probably outrun one in a modern Turbo S today.
Yeah.
At least to a certain speed, maybe not to the top, certainly. There's something so much more special about them than that. And that, you know, you see the inside and how well they've aged and all these things. So I'll include these videos and you guys can check it out. I have such a soft spot for these. For me, it's the same sort of thing that makes me love the SR71.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing is just this, like, look at the stats on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. It has aged well. And it is crazy that that's 20 years old. I mean, there potentially are a few listeners that are listening right now that were, you know, either toddlers or born in that year. It's kind of crazy to think that a car that still seems very relevant and very kind of new and modern and just almost futuristic.
Well, kind of established the broader concept of a hypercar,
yeah,
which of course is now like a whole category.
Right.
2005 to 2015 was the era of the Bugatti Veyron. So
yeah.
Check that out if you look back on that era with any interest, or if you weren't aware of that episode of Top Gear because you're lucky enough to have been young enough to have not seen it in the first place, because these are some delightful episodes of television if you like cars.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Good one.
And with it, what's your final note for the week?
Yeah, I realized that I've been using final notes to talk about articles that I've read that often come behind a paywall, and I apologize for that. I'll try to amend that, but I would guess that you can either get a gift link, or some of you might subscribe to the New York Times online, and there's a great story, I believe it was published August 5th here, so about 3 weeks ago, called Bite Club, the fraternity that awaits you after a shark attack. And it's
yikes,
really a fascinating story about a group that was kind of founded in Australia for obvious reasons for people that have had, you know, have been attacked by sharks, probably, you know, bull sharks, great whites, tiger sharks, things like that. And it's now kind of an international club, if you will, that I believe kind of exists mainly on Facebook, but it has over 500 members. And it's kind of become like almost it's one of those things, I suppose, like, you know, if you're attacked by a shark, bitten by a shark, whether, you know, you have to have a leg or an arm amputated or just have major scars. I mean, it must be it's a very traumatic event that not many people can relate to. And so this club was sort of formed by people that could relate to each other, whether it was, you know, recovering from, you know, nerve damage or, you know, amputees or just trying to get over the trauma of, you know, do you want to get back in the water again? And it's quite a fascinating story about, you know, how these people, you know, some of them have met up in person, but it's largely online. But it's you know, like one of these small groups that of people that share a very unique traumatic experience and how they're kind of supporting each other. And it was really an interesting story about this group and its members. So yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in there. It's called Bite Club, the fraternity that awaits you after a shark attack.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I clicked on the link and I got the prompt to you know, pay 50 cents a week for the first however many weeks, and it's, you know, however many thousands of dollars after that. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out for sure. Very cool story. Great. And I guess it's surprising that exists, but at the same time, it makes perfect sense that, like, if you had been bit by a shark, you would want to talk to other people who had that experience.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's the plot of horror films.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
My guess is there's support groups for people who have other violent things happen to them, and this makes sense in some way. But yeah, that's a fascinating kind of peg for a story for sure. Good recommendation.
It's kind of like it makes me think about the MB-1, you know, the Bremont that was only available to people that ejected from an airplane. You know, it's a pretty small club. Like, maybe a watch company needs to come up with a dive watch that is only available to those who've been attacked by a shark, although I'm not sure that's appropriate or whatever, but there's a hook for you if anybody wants that idea.
I can think of a few brands who would at least try that.
Yeah, right.
Would send out the press release.
All right.
Well, hey man, that was a fun episode. Thanks so much for that, and thank you to everyone who showed up in Brooklyn to represent TGN and support Jason for that dive watch launch. And look, I'm going to say it one more time. Please, if you're coming to the Toronto Timepiece Show and can stick around for Sunday night, we would love to see you at the party, and we're going to have a really good time like we did last year. So hit the RSVP link in the show notes if you're interested.
Yep.
And as always, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or even consider supporting the show directly, maybe even grab yourself a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from the Scotsman Thomas Carlyle, who said, "A well-written life is almost as rare as a well-spent one."